Morning, we're delighted to welcome with us additional students from Southwest Wisconsin Technical College. Would they please stand? You were here before, you can stand again anyway. All right. Thank you. You may be seated. We determined in the during the last oral argument that some, if not all of you, would be available right after this argument, and therefore Justice Rogensack will be available and will discuss with you all the procedures involved in deciding which cases to take and how we decide cases, but not a discussion of the substantive issues involved. And anyone who wishes to remain for that, you need not be a student. You're welcome to do so. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, we are going to hear 06AP948, Darnell Jackson versus Daniel Beekler. This is our second oral argument on this case. The first was in December of 2009. There have been proceedings in the circuit court after we heard oral argument on remand from this court. There's been additional briefing by both parties relating to the remand, and additional materials have been sent. And Mr. Halfringer, when you agreed to take this case on a pro bono basis, I don't know what you knew what you were getting yourself in for, and that you did not expect you or your law firm to have this as a lifetime commitment. But, and I say that somewhat in jest, but we do appreciate your efforts. So you have 25 minutes. And it's my understanding that Mr. Jackson has access to these oral arguments. Is that correct? Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. To set the stage, at base, this case presents the issue of whether the disciplinary committee's finding that Mr. Jackson incited a riot can stand when a video that the Department of Corrections removed from the certiorari record evidences events inconsistent with the disciplinary committee's findings and the confidential informant's testimony on which those findings were based, but which is consistent with Mr. Jackson's witnesses, which the disciplinary committee ignored. Because the video that the warden ordered removed from the record contradicts those findings in the confidential informant's testimony, the disciplinary committee's ruling must be reversed for three grounds. First, the process that the Department of Corrections used in this case was not in accordance with law. When the warden realized that the video did not substantiate the finding of guilt, he ordered the video removed rather than instruct the disciplinary committee to consider that video in connection with the other evidence and reconsider its findings. Second, with considering the video that is as part of the record properly constituted, the evidence does not substantially support the finding that Mr. Jackson incited the riot. And third, by not presenting the video and affording Mr. Jackson the opportunity to use that video in his defense, the Department of Corrections violated Mr. Jackson's due process rights. Now, on remand, the circuit court reviewed the video and concluded that the video was not material and was not exculpatory. But with respect, the circuit court asked the wrong question. The circuit court asked the question of whether the video conclusively confirmed Mr. Jackson's statement that he never left the barbershop. Again, by way of setting the stage, the confidential informant's testimony was that Mr. Jackson left the barbershop seconds before the riot started to meet with the inmates who committed the riot, who assaulted the guards, and that this meeting with inmates Vest, Kinney, and Treadwell occurred out in the hallway, and that all of them were huddled up first, and that the testimony was that Mr. Jackson came out of the barbershop, Vest and the others who committed the assault were met in the hallway by Mr. Jackson. Mr. Jackson went back in the barbershop, and that's when those other individuals assaulted the guards.
Counselor, I want to be sure I understand what your argument is. If you look at the test, essentially, that was applied by the circuit court, it sounds like she was considering whether this was Brady evidence. But in your three narratives, you talk about due process rights. And the reason I ask you this question is because of the Supreme Court's recent decision in Osborne, which says that Brady is the wrong analysis post-conviction. Now, it's not a disciplinary matter. It's post-conviction in a criminal proceeding, and I'm sure you're aware of the case. But the court does say you do look at a due process analysis. That's the analysis. So what I'd like to know from you is, are you asking us to say Brady applies in a prison disciplinary proceeding, or are you saying we simply examine whether his due process rights to a fair hearing were violated? Or kind of where are you? So I'm sure I understand what your argument is.
We are saying that this court should hold that Brady applies in the manner that the Seventh Circuit has held, that Brady applies in the prison disciplinary context. But I believe that is also to say that we are arguing that by not providing the video, that the state deprived Mr. Jackson of due process, because Brady, of course, is a due process principle.
It's just a different analysis, though, than our regular substantive due process analysis.
Yes, that's fair. And as the Seventh Circuit...
You're not arguing substantive due process.
Not substantive due process.
You're arguing procedural due process.
Procedural due process, and that as under Brady, that when there is exculpatory evidence that is either requested or that where the state has reason to know that it is exculpatory, that that evidence has to be provided to, in this context, the inmate, to be used in his defense.
So your analysis is a Brady analysis.
It is a Brady analysis.
Okay. Right.
We would recognize that as the Seventh Circuit has acknowledged in cases like Piggy versus... the second Piggy case, Piggy versus Cotton, actually the second Piggy versus Cotton case, the third Piggy case, believe it or not. This is at 344 F3rd. Yes, it's how many Piggies, right? 344 F3rd.
All the way home.
Exactly, Your Honor. F3rd 674. The Seventh Circuit said there may be some. There, the state in the disciplinary context started to play the video and then took Mr. Piggy out of the room and refused further to show him the video and would not allow him to use it. And the Seventh Circuit reversed that and said the state made no showing in that context that there was some security reason for not showing the video. Similarly here, this case does not present an argument that there is some security context. So it may be slightly, the application of Brady versus Maryland in this context might be different because you have these overlapping penological concerns such as security, but not in this case. This case does not present that issue. It merely presents the issue of whether or not under Brady, that is to say, as a matter of due process, Mr. Jackson should have been afforded the opportunity to use the video in his defense.
I have a much more simple concept here. When you tell me due process, I think fairness, right? And you got cases in prisoner discipline and otherwise that say some basic concepts of fairness. One, you got to give them notice, right? He got notice. He had notice of the hearing, right?
Yes.
Two, you got to give him an opportunity to appear, in person or otherwise. You got to give a person opportunity to hear the evidence against them so that they can meaningfully answer it, right?
Yes.
I'm not sure you have to give them a right of appeal, but you can you have to tell them what it is to the extent possible. Here you have confidential informants and you have it in other types of cases, and that's acceptable under certain rules, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what's unfair here? You said, I mean, to be a very simplistic, so I don't have to deal with Brady and get into Brady and decide when it applies and when it doesn't. I'm not sure I have to do that in this case. You said that the DOC didn't use its own procedures. It didn't follow its own procedures here. Well, when the government doesn't follow what it says it's going to do, that is viewed as a violation of fair play, because the government makes us do what it says.
What you've left off your list of fundamentally required procedures, Your Honor, is the procedure of being able to present evidence in your defense.
Right.
That was a procedure that was recognized in the disciplinary context by the United States Supreme Court in Wolf versus McDonald. And that's the crux of applying Brady in the prison disciplinary context. It's the ability to present evidence in your own defense. And you can't present that evidence if the state doesn't make it available and if the state takes it out of the record. It's fundamentally unfair. Yes, Your Honor, I agree with you. It's a question of fairness ultimately.
Okay. So here, according to this record, the committee, you looked at the video. We don't know what video, but looked at video, right?
Yes.
The warden looked at a video, right?
Yes.
Okay. We don't know what video, but he looked at a video, right?
That his memorandum says that he looked at the video and found, he looked at video and found that it did not substantiate Mr. Jackson's guilt.
That's right. Case comes up here, no video. Now, this is a certiorari proceeding, right?
Yes.
And we're supposed to get the whole record, right?
Yes.
They didn't send the whole record.
Correct.
All right. Now, we sent it back and said, get the record. Are you going to show us this video, or is this just a in our way?
Yes, Your Honor, to the extent that you are suggesting that this whole proceeding has gone off the tracks when the state took whatever video there was that the disciplinary committee actually had out of the record, that alone is sufficient to vacate the ruling. I completely agree with you. The Court of Appeals had it right in Lomax, and that's what they held. You can't change the procedure. You can't. The state cannot obstruct the court's ability to meaningfully review the agency's findings by allowing the agency to say, oh, we are going to take evidence out of the record. But, Your Honor, this court ordered a remand and ordered the state to produce the video. The state produced video. The court ordered the circuit court to decide to watch that video and decide whether or not it's material and exculpatory. That court decided it's not. I believe that's wrong as a matter of fact and wrong as a matter of law. And
why?
That's why we get to the video.
Okay. Why? Just what's the standard for deciding whether it's exculpatory or material? What's the standard? You got it in your brief.
The standard is de novo. Although this court has not addressed that question, the two circuit courts of the United States have held that it is a de novo review, something sort of like the Fourth Amendment question of whether or not something is reasonable.
I know, but what's the standard for deciding whether it's material? That is
the test.
Yes.
Right, not the standard of review, but the test. And it's not whether there's absolute clarity.
Something is material, Your Honor, if there's a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different had that evidence been considered.
And you're saying that's not the test the judge used.
Yes. We believe that even this video, and again, you're right, we don't know that this was the only video available. Maybe there is others, and it is surprising that this is the only video because neither in this segment of video nor the others that the state produced is the riot actually shown. It's all quite odd, frankly. But the video that we have meets that standard of being exculpatory because it shows, and we now have a stipulation on this, it shows, there's a stipulation that two of the persons who committed the riot, Vest and Kinney, I believe it is, are shown in the video. Stipulation of Mr. Jackson is nowhere shown in the video. The video shows Vest and Kinney, and Mr. Jackson offered to prove in the circuit court that also the third rioting inmate, Treadwell, was among them, together moving toward the guards station, toward the other side of the two halls that make up the correctional institution, but again, does not show Mr. Jackson. And I guess this would be a proper time with the court's leave to have the Marshall play.
It was
video.
A stipulation that we can see this. I assume that's still there. There's also a stipulation that, if I remember it, that video camera was not at all times at the door of the barbershop. Therefore, it's possible that within the seconds it's not there, something else happened, which is not on the video. Right?
It is certainly conceded that the camera does not show the barbershop door at all times, and that will be obvious when you see it. But at some point, especially perhaps in the beginning of the video or maybe afterwards, it is possible that someone could have entered or exited the barbershop. But I don't agree that it is plausible, at least, that anyone, including Mr. Jackson, entered or exited the barbershop at the relevant time.
And that's the inference you want us to draw. Okay.
Right.
We should play it, and I'm wondering if one of these can be turned around.
No. I think it will also play.
Oh, is it playing down there? I'm sorry. Okay.
So before you play the video, I just want to make sure. There are two counts, right? One is inciting a riot, for which he was found guilty. The other is group resistance and petition, for which he was found not guilty, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And just in my mind again, the exculpatory evidence in this video is the fact that he's not in the video.
Right. He was found to have incited the riot on the testimony of the confidential informants that he huddled, as they said, with the rioting inmates and called it, as they said, for at that time during the huddle, he called the riot. And that was the basis for finding him to have incited the riot. So it is during this supposed meeting and this calling that was the only evidence on which he was found to have incited the riot. So if this meeting never occurred, there is no evidence at all that the riot was incited by Mr. Jackson.
There's no testimony in the record at all that he was part of a meeting at some time.
All the testimony is that he met with these persons, and the conduct report that the disciplinary committee adopted found that this meeting happened seconds before the riot occurred, and that's indeed the state's position when we came here last December. As we will show, the video seconds before the riot occurred, it doesn't show Mr. Jackson, that's stipulated, but it does show these other inmates out in this hallway on their way to the guard station.
Counselor, before you show the video, I just want to be sure I'm understanding the record, and if you could get appendix page 20, which is the disciplinary hearing written little sheet that you folks gave us in our appendix. I don't know if it's your appendix or the other side. It's A-020, but it is the disciplinary hearing written results.
I am with you.
Okay, thank you. At this hearing, as Justice Ziegler pointed out, there were two charges. The inciting charge he was convicted of, he was found, according to this report, not guilty of 303.20. What would he have had to have done in 303.20 to be guilty? Participate in the riot?
That's my understanding.
Okay. At the top of this report, it says disciplinary hearing, then it says reasons for the decision and evidence relied on. Is there some reason, in your view, that we should say that the video was relied on to show his guilt rather than to show his innocence under 303.20? In other words, it doesn't show him participating. You guys have stipulated to that. So why isn't the video relevant to that? And that's why they used it rather than something that has anything to do really with whether he incited.
Well, our position is, Your Honor, that it shows both, that it is evidence relied upon by the committee in making its ruling. It was evidence considered by the committee. So it was before the important part is that it was before the committee and considered by it. And if it showed, as this video shows, that he was not huddled with these inmates at that time, then it should have led to the conclusion that he not only was not guilty of committing the riot, but that he was not guilty of inciting the riot.
Well, yes and no, and that's what you folks are arguing to us about. But certainly it does show, because it shows the people that were committing the riot, that he wasn't there involved in that, correct? So it is relevant to his finding of not guilty under 303.20.
Well, if this is the only video evidence that the committee considered, and again, going back to the Chief Justice's point, that's not at all clear at this point, but if that's the only video that it was considered, and it's been produced by the state as video that was considered, it doesn't support anything about who committed the riot because it doesn't actually show the persons who committed the riot. And so if it was relied upon in this context, it has to be relied upon in the sense of this was evidence that the committee considered that was used by the investigators and the investigative report that the committee adopted, and it was relied upon in that sense.
Mr. Halfinger, look at the small print. It says evidence. I'm looking at the same page, A020, right above the boxes. See that?
There's a lot of small print, Your Honor.
The evidence, parenthetical.
Okay.
The committee relies on the following evidence in finding the offender guilty. It doesn't say the committee relied on the following evidence in determining guilt.
Yes, you're right, Your Honor.
It says finding guilt.
You're right.
Now, if they were paying attention to the little print, they should have just been dealing with guilt.
Yes, I agree.
Because on the acquittal, you don't have to worry about it. So it's finding the offender guilty. Now, maybe that's just bad drafting. And that what it really means in determining the issue. But if you take them at their word, they're only looking at this for the one that they found guilty.
Given that this is all that we have, I submit that we should take them at their word on that.
Okay. Thank you. Are we ready?
No.
Yeah. Okay. Justice Prosser.
You're going to show, I think, a segment of a part of a video. Is that right?
I believe we're going to, yes, we're going to show a portion of a segment that starts from the beginning of the segment and runs through to where the guards are obviously running to the other side. And the inference we would draw is that they were responding to the riot and the incident report, the investigative report, says that the guards responded about a minute after the riot starts. We cut it off at that point because nothing of note happens after that point.
Okay. You're going to show us a portion of a video that is identified as A unit, side 1, start 1336, end 1347. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
What does 1336 mean?
If I had to guess, and it is only a guess because the true answer is I don't know. I simply received this video we watched it, quite frankly. But my guess would be that that is the time either kept by the machine that keeps the time, which may or may not be consistent with the time on the ground, if you will, or it may be consistent with that time. So the riot occurred at 1:40, or in military time, 1340. Perhaps this has some correspondence to that, but again, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that allows us to be certain about that. We infer that this occurs immediately before the riot because we can see the guards respond and rush off to the other side at the end of the portion of this clip that we will play for you.
Can you think of any plausible alternative interpretation of 1336? I mean, there's no dispute that this riot occurred at 1:40. That's what's in the reports. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, and you're going to show us a portion of a video that begins at 1336, which is 1:36 military time.
But, Your Honor, the problem is that I think it's much more likely that the 36 stamp really is the time on the machine that keeps this, because it is clear that at a time less than 4 minutes from the beginning that the guards are obviously rushing over and there's activity on the other side. And if you watch the other segments, my recollection is you can make those line up with different times in the other segments from when there is activity on the other side. So I cannot be certain. I don't believe, Your Honor, that one can just rush to the conclusion that this was 1:36 in the afternoon of November 11, 2004.
So are you suggesting that maybe it's later than 1:36?
I am suggesting that it occurs, the beginning of this clip occurs about 2 minutes or so before, actually 1 minute before that the riot happens, about 2 minutes before the guards respond to the riot.
Okay. But now let's say 5 minutes before the riot. Is there any video that shows what was in the hallway 5 minutes before the riot?
Not this segment. I don't recall how far back the other A unit segment goes, and I don't know whether or not there's. I just don't recall whether or not there's any markers that would lead one to be able to determine that with any certainty. Again, Your Honor, this is the unfortunate nature of trying to reconstruct the record in the way that we are trying to reconstruct it.
These are the only tapes you got from the department.
Yes.
Was it the representation made to you that these were the same tapes that the disciplinary committee looked at?
Well, I would allow the state to speak to that, but my understanding is that these are videos of the incident and the only ones that the state now has. But again, I would defer to the Attorney General's office on that.
Oh, so you don't, I guess what I thought we referred the matter back to the trial court for was for the trial court to look at the videos that the warden took out of the record. And I guess my question to you was to assure myself that's what we're going to look at.
Yes, the order said that the state was to produce the video and that the circuit court was to review it. The state produced these videos and the circuit court reviewed them. I just cannot say with any certainty at all beyond that whether or not there were other videos that ever existed, or and that issue was not before the circuit court viewed all of that as beyond the scope of the remand order.
Well, we remanded it for the circuit court to look at the video that the warden took out of the record. I mean, I think that's pretty specific. If there were 25 other videos, we weren't talking about them. And I'm concerned now because maybe you feel you didn't get the right video or?
Well, again, I would defer to Ms. Potts on this, but the state produced videos. It says these are the videos that we have, and the circuit court reviewed them. We proceeded, and here we are today.
Okay, we'll ask the same question of the state. So the state should be prepared to respond as to what it could or could not or did produce. And no witnesses were produced. Warden wasn't produced to determine what he saw, and no one from the discipline committee testified. Okay.
Right.
Let's see the...
A little bit more. Counsel, you submitted a very extensive appendix early on last year. And I thought I read in that appendix that the petitioner, Mr. Jackson, admits that he was in the hallway at some time during the whole incident.
Yes, Jackson's statement suggests that he, at some point, ducked outside to see what was going on.
Okay. So he ducked out. There's a commotion. There's a commotion, and he ducked out of the barbershop. Is that on the video?
That is not on the video.
But didn't he also indicate that he went up to the desk to ask to be let into the barbershop at one point, and he came out in the hallway another time, all those two before the incident. Isn't that right in your record?
Yes, as well as his testimony that he did not meet with these individuals in the hallway as testified to by the confidential informants. These are all good questions, Your Honor, but they are all questions that we believe goes to the fact that that's why this video should have been reviewed in fairness by the disciplinary committee and by Mr. Jackson at that time to get an accurate determination and accurate findings of whether or not Mr. Jackson had any involvement in this riot.
This video was not shown at the hearing.
Correct.
Mr. Jackson didn't see it, even though the disciplinary committee did.
Correct.
Well, Mr. Jackson knew there was video of the whole hallway from beginning. And not just the little thing here, but all day long there was video, wasn't there?
I'm not quite sure the proposal. I mean, there's nothing in the record that shows what Mr. Jackson knew or didn't know about the video. If one wants to take judicial notice of
that. Right in the incident report, the conduct report, there are two references to the videos that were examined. It doesn't say 1336 in the report. This video is available. He didn't ask for that video.
Yes, Justice Prosser. The video is certainly identified as in the evidence relied upon portion of the disciplinary report, which was done after the finding of guilt. Also, the video is identified, as we have stated before, in the conduct report, which presumably was available. My only point was there's nothing in the record knowing the extent to which Mr. Jackson knew what video might show at the time. And we would argue that the state had a duty to turn that video over because it looked at it. And if it looked at it, it should have known that there was a serious probability that it showed that Mr. Jackson was not at this meeting, that the confidential informants that the state chose to rely upon was testifying to.
Do the CIs say that the meeting occurred right before the riot?
The
in the hallway right before the riot, or could the meeting have been earlier that day? I mean, to me, when I just am trying to look at their testimony, it doesn't really say right before the riot the three of us met in the hallway. And so it calls into question whether that's really exculpatory, because I'm not clear as to whether the meeting was that day, moments before the riot, whether it occurred a different day. Where's the and then, you know, if we don't know the timing, how is the video necessarily exculpatory?
We are hobbled a little bit by the fact that all we have are excerpts of the confidential informant's testimony. It was only the investigators, of course, who got the full story as whether accurate or inaccurate from the confidential informants. But even among those excerpts, the excerpts indicated that Treadwell, Jackson, and Kenny were huddled up first in the hallway, suggesting first before the incident. And one of the inmates testified that Jackson came out of the barbershop, talked to Vest, and then went back to the barbershop, and that's when, as it says, them guys went back behind the desk and assaulted the guards. But most important of all, the conduct report, which was written by the investigators who actually talked to these persons, presumably, said that the meeting occurred seconds before the assault on the guards. And that conduct report, the statements of the conduct report, were accepted in the disciplinary committee in the document we're looking at that is on A20.
Right, any other questions before we see this? Dave, Justice Prosser, do you have a question?
Let's roll the tape.
Okay. Cut one. Are you in charge?
Yes.
So this is the beginning of the video, and as I suggested, it takes a few seconds to get to the point that we believe important.
Are we looking at the day room?
This is, A unit, side one. And in a moment or two, we will see the camera swing around. As will become evident in a moment, the guard station is where the riot occurred, is at the forefront of the video as we are now watching it. And when it swings around, we will see individuals gathered, and those are the individuals that has been stipulated to that are Vest and Kenny. Those individuals right there, and now looking to the left is the barbershop door right there.
Where?
The individuals are there again, and it'll come back around in a second.
We're dealing only with one camera.
This is what we have, Your Honor.
Okay. Just asking.
It swings back around now, and we'll show again the area outside. The individuals are now going toward the doorway where the guard station is. The barbershop door is there. It now stays in this area right outside the barbershop door for some period of time, and this will be the time either when the riot is now occurring or soon before the riot occurs, because first, recalling that the incident report says that it takes about a minute for the guards to respond, we see the guards come out, and then there will be, in a second or two, an obvious time in which the guards respond and go dramatically over to the other side, which is the A2 side. And looking at the video, if the court wants to, it has it. Looking at the video of the A2 side is where persons are actually handcuffed and detained at the end of one of the segments. And this is where they then flee over to the other side. So there is a long period of time, conceding that it doesn't continuously show the barbershop door, although there it is again. There is a long period of time in which, from the time that the inmates who assaulted the guards are shown until the time in which there is a response to the riot on the other side, that the area outside of the barbershop is shown. And again, it's been stipulated to that Mr. Jackson is not in any of these videos.
I'm sorry.
The door to the barbershop is there by the garbage can. That's the door to the barbershop.
Oh, on this lower level?
Yes. Oh, yes.
So you're only...
The door's on the upper level.
You're only going to see the barbershop door when there is a focus on the guard station?
Correct.
And if it's really focused on the guard station and isn't swung, you're not going to see the door at all.
When you first see the inmates who perpetrated the riot, when they first come into view, when the camera swings around where you can't see the barbershop door, but it is not more than a second or two when you can see the bottom of the barbershop door.
Have we seen enough? Is this what you want us to see?
Yeah, we
can. Is this still part of the 2 minutes, or?
No, this is the segment that we were looking to find. At this point, consistent with the conduct report, I believe that the inmates have been sent to their cells, and the area has been cleared, and my assumption is that people are being detained on the other side. So this really is the segment that we wanted to show.
Why is this exculpatory?
Because, again, the only evidence that was used to convict to find Mr. Jackson guilty of inciting the riot was that he huddled up seconds before the riot occurs, and seconds before, those rioting inmates are outside of there walking over to the other area, huddled up. And if one watches it slowly, there's another inmate, it may well be Ward, who is pointing. But Mr. Jackson is nowhere in there. Mr. Jackson is nowhere in there at all.
Did the tape show this huddle?
As Your Honor may have seen, and it's become more obvious if you
watch it.
Well,
it was very difficult to watch and observe. But according to you, you've been narrating in response to questions from the bench and on your own, did this tape supposedly show the huddle?
Well, first, the confidential informant said there was a huddle. Mm-hmm. There may never have been a huddle because Mr. Jackson, he says and his witnesses said he never went out in the hall.
You haven't had a problem opining about what's on the tape so far.
But if there was a huddle, Your Honor, then it does show those inmates grouped together in what might characterize as a huddle.
It did?
It shows them walking together.
So is it possible that Mr. Jackson could have been walking with them or huddled with them before the tape starts or at some time when the camera's not on that group?
It's possible that he could have been in the hallway before the tape started, but that would not be seconds before.
Well, how many seconds?
Excuse me?
Well, you're saying that wouldn't be seconds. How many seconds do you mean?
Well, here is a couple of minutes worth of seconds. That is not something that I think would be a standard use of seconds before.
The tape shows minutes of the huddle? I thought you said it was a brief period.
It shows, not the huddle, of the period of time before those persons are walking through. And I was responding to your question about whether or not he could have been meeting with them before this tape even started. And my point was that if he met with these persons before this tape even starts, that would not be consistent with seconds before.
Or it might not just be on the tape.
Excuse me?
Or it might not just be on this tape, for whatever reason.
Well, I don't believe it could be on this tape and have him, consistent with the testimony, go out of the barbershop, meet with them, and go back with the barbershop seconds before the incident occurs. I don't believe that that's plausible with this tape. And the important thing as to materiality is whether or not there's a probability that it would make a difference. The question is whether or not one would want to use this if representing Mr. Jackson. One would want to show this tape and say, hey, wait a minute. These confidential informants' testimony and the findings of the investigative report was that Jackson was huddled with these guys seconds before the riot. Well, look at this video. Here's the guys that committed the riot. He's not out there. How do you explain that? That's something that a person defending Mr. Jackson himself, would have wanted to use in his defense, and that makes it material. That means that it should have been available to him to use in his defense.
And Jackson couldn't cross-examine the confidential witnesses.
No, but he certainly could have argued to the disciplinary committee that the findings were substantially suspect if that's all they were based on, given what it is reported that those confidential informants said.
Thank you, Counselor.
Is there something in here which I remember reading that he thinks that the confidential informants were the instigators and are just pushing it off on him?
Yes, I can't give you the page at the moment, but he proposed that he had had a run-in with one of the confidential informants and that they were basically pinning it on him.
Okay. Thank you. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Abigail Potts, who's an assistant attorney general, representing the respondent.
Good morning. My name is Abigail Potts. I'm with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I'm here this morning on
behalf
of the respondent.
You'll have to speak more directly into the microphone so we can hear you. You can move the microphone. If you want to raise the podium, you may.
Okay. How's this? Is it better?
Fine.
I'm here on
behalf. Looks uncomfortable, but go ahead.
I'm here on behalf of the respondents, Matthew Frank and Dan Buckler. We've just seen the video, and I'm not going to go through and re-argue a lot of the arguments that we addressed in the previous oral argument and the previous briefing in this case. I think I want to touch on two primary issues here this morning and then any questions the court has, and I know I've heard some questions that you have. The first issue that I want to address is that although the respondents continue to maintain that the video is not properly part of the record on return in this case, if it is considered in this court's certiorari review, there is still sufficient evidence in the record in order to sustain the committee's findings of guilt here. And secondly, I want to address the fact that this really is not a Brady violation case. This is a sufficiency of the record on return case. However, if this case is characterized and continues to be characterized as a Brady violation case, Jackson's Brady claim fails because he never requested to see the video at or before the hearing, and because there's no evidence in the record to even suspect that the video is material and exculpatory.
If the warden didn't think that this video, or any video, whatever it was relevant, and wanted it struck, because that's his right of review, right? But if you strike evidence, it's still in the record. It may not go to the jury if it's a jury trial, but it's in the physical record. It comes up here. Here it was struck, meaning deleted. So it seems to me the full record never came up here on certiorari.
You raise a good point. I think, though, where there's a misconception here is that the warden in his correction in the record did not strike the video. The warden looked, didn't even, it does not say the warden reviewed the video. The warden looked at the conduct report.
Well, you better look at that. Doesn't the warden say, I looked at the video?
It's on page 115 of the appendix. And what he says is he looks at the conduct report, and he can find no substantiation that there was a video showing Jackson's involvement in this incident. And we submit that what the warden did was review the conduct report and say, there's an error on the hearing decision sheet. They included a video on the evidence relied on, but there's no video under the section of the conduct report that talks about the charges against Jackson, and there's no discussion of a video used in the actual reasons for the decision on the hearing committee sheet.
What about that box checked?
Right. That's the error that we would submit the warden identified.
How does the warden know what they saw or didn't see? Did he talk to him? I mean, the report says they saw it. That's what that report says. It says the committee relies on the following evidence. Video, twice. How does the warden know they didn't see the video?
And that's where the record doesn't say. And it would have been nice if the warden had given a little bit more explanation in his correction. But if you really look at his letter, his correction letter, it is a procedural correction. It's a detection of an error. He ordered it be corrected. It was corrected. If you look at the hearing decision sheet, that was taken off. I believe it was the disciplinary committee members had to go back and remove it.
Just as an aside, I find it a little odd that I'm looking at A020 of the appendix, a little odd that the photo-video is crossed out, but then, I'm looking at the left-hand column in the middle of the page under evidence, but then video is also the last inserted word And that's not crossed out. So why cross out one video and not cross out the other? Do you have...
No, and unfortunately, I can't tell you why that's the case. It's possible there was another, and I don't know if this is in the appendix or not. It's possible there's another version of the hearing decision sheet where they're all crossed out. I would have to go back and look, But
counsel, you're opposing. Oh, I'm sorry. Were you done? I didn't.
Yeah.
Mean
no,
it.
I'm fine.
All right. Your opposing counsel suggests and takes the position that Brady applies to prison discipline cases. What is your response to that?
Well, and I would urge the court to go back and kind of look at our briefing on that issue when we briefed it more in full the first time around. It is our position that the Seventh Circuit's extension of the Brady rule is not controlling here, and it has not been extended by the United States Supreme Court, and it has not been extended by this state. So at this point, it does not apply. Whether it should or not is another issue, and we don't think this is the case to determine that because, as I said earlier, this really, in our view, is not a true Brady case because there none of the prerequisites were established at the administrative level for us to really review a Brady claim here. There was never any request to see the video. The prison officials were never given any opportunity to justify a security concern.
Let's just assume for the purposes of our discussion that there may be some members of the court who want to consider it. What would be your argument in that regard?
As to whether or not it should be applied?
Yes.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, I think we recognize the rationale behind the Seventh Circuit's extension. We understand the fair play notion behind that. However, what we disagree with is the fact that it can be applied here in a way that doesn't overburden prison officials. And that is our main concern. We don't know how, if this court determines that it should be applied, we don't know how to tell you how to do it without overburdening the system in a lot of ways. It is a criminal procedure issue. And this is, and to try to kind of force it on a prison disciplinary context is going to have a lot of difficulties.
Did Mr. Jackson receive a sanction as a consequence of the committee of his conduct as found by the committee?
What triggered his due process right here is the fact that his mandatory release date was extended.
Okay.
So when he was transferred, I believe he was, and I can't recall exactly, but I believe he was transferred to another facility.
All right.
But his mandatory release date was extended, so if he's supposed to be released on day one, it was extended so that he couldn't be released until day something or other.
Correct.
How long a period was that?
It's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. It looks like
179 days.
That might
at be. A-117, perhaps.
Okay.
It looks like he requested information. You know, my MR date is extended due to conduct report 1731337. You know, what is it? And information was 179.
How many days is that?
I don't have it here before me.
Page A117 in the appendix,
seven.
Roughly.
I know that
But it should be a due process violation or not, even if it's one day, right? So...
I see, yeah. 179 days, that's what it says here.
179 days more in prison.
Correct.
And that's what triggers the due process analysis.
In this case, yeah.
In this case.
Right.
Unfold, if you will, for me, the due process argument absent the Brady argument.
Well, we would say that really he does not have a viable procedural due process claim here without his Brady argument because he was given notice. He was given notice of the charges against him, and the conduct report is thorough and gives a lengthy description of the evidence that the conduct report is based on. And he was given an opportunity to be heard and to submit a defense, which is really where the Brady rule is an extension of, that right to provide a defense. He got his witnesses, he submitted his own written evidence, and he was given a thorough written decision.
Well, he wasn't entitled to some of the witnesses he wanted.
That's correct. It was determined, which I don't think is really a matter properly before us here because it wasn't challenged, but it is raised in opposing counsel's post-remand briefing. But he was properly denied his witnesses for not showing cause for needing more than two, and that is kind of standard protocol. You need to show a reason why they would be different or important to you, and he didn't do that. So I think that we have, you know, as we discussed in our post-remand briefing, kind of some of the complexities with this case have really stemmed from what we would say is a mischaracterization of the video issue. On appeal, that issue has morphed into this purely procedural due process issue, this Brady claim violation issue, when we really feel as though that the removal of the video is a matter of the sufficiency of the record on return, which the circuit court affirmed when the circuit court denied his motion to strike the return and affirmed the warden's decision correcting the decision sheet. And he didn't appeal that issue. He didn't challenge that issue. He morphed into this Brady claim violation issue, but I think that's where some of the complexities in this case stem from. But that's also why we continue to maintain that the video really is not properly part of the record on return in this case, because there was a process by which it was taken out, and that wasn't challenged.
Well, let me just pause, because there's a process by which it was partially taken out. Unless there is something in the record that isn't before us, the record that is before us still has one of the video words still there.
Correct. Yeah, that's the crux of this case. You know, that's why there is this problem here with it. And that was the error that the warden sought to correct before it was sent up. And where I think there's a distinction is it doesn't then all of a sudden become a Brady violation claim, because we've already gotten beyond the point where he has, you know, he made no allegations that he wasn't allowed to present a defense either at the hearing or at any administrative level. And so what we have is a sufficiency of the record on return kind of argument, but that takes us now into the remand. And what effect does the remand have? The remand, really, the findings of the remand, and the circuit court was directed to make findings consistent with a Brady rule determination.
When the warden reviews it, does he look at under the procedures of the department, which may or may not be written, you may or may not know, does he look at everything? Does he look at the conduct report? Does he look at the statement of the witnesses? Does he look at, would he look at the physical evidence presented, including the video?
Did the warden?
The warden.
Yeah, well, it depends.
Did the warden have which is what was raised before, did the warden have these videos?
It's a good question. I think that's one thing that has been kind of misconstrued here, too. This was not a review, an automatic appeal. It had already been appealed administratively. This was the warden was exerting his authority under a section of the regulations that allows him to go in and make procedural corrections and find that if they're harmless error, there's no change to the actual substantive decision. Okay. That's what was going on here. And that's,
what's the citation to that?
Sure. It's Wisconsin Administrative Code, Section DOC 303.76.
Just take it a little slower.
Sure.
Wisconsin Administrative Code.
It's DOC.
DOC.
303.76, subsection 7E.
Okay.
And so we see it as much more of a, it was a procedural correction.
Yeah, but he had to have seen the video.
It does not say that he looked at the video. It is our interpretation of his letter that he looked at the conduct report, was probably preparing, if someone was preparing the record for return, and they're like, why is the video in here?
He says, I have again reviewed this conduct report. The first thing in the conduct report is that there are videos, right?
Right, but that doesn't mean he viewed the videos.
I can find no substantiation that there was a video showing Mr. Jackson's involvement. How can he say that unless he looked at the video?
It's a good question. There is no, we don't know. We're speculating.
Sure.
Yeah,
I know. So we can say the warden struck the video without looking at it because, in his opinion, it wouldn't substantiate his involvement. Doesn't quite make sense.
It's awkward wording. I think it's our position that the warden said, correct the hearing decision sheet because there wasn't a video relied on. And there's no indication in the...
Even though they said in two places they found guilt on video. Okay. All right. I just want to know what this means. And
so
then he says...
As it stands now, although we would still argue that the video is outside the scope of the record and return in this case properly, it is now technically part of like it or not, it's now technically part of the appeals record, and it's specifically document 45.
How'd you pick these videos?
These are the videos I contacted Department of Corrections to give me all the video events you have on New Lisbon, and they give us a CD with four video clips. This is one of those four video clips.
What precisely did you ask for?
All video evidence on the riots. And this is what we got. And I think this is probably, I mean, you can look at it, this is the relevant area. It just happens to be, it's frustrating because the camera angle shifts so much that it's our position that the video simply doesn't contradict any of the evidence relied on, including the conduct report, and including the statement in the conduct report that says that Jackson met with rioters seconds before the attack. I mean, we're talking about a short enough period of time. I would disagree with opposing counsel that this could all be characterized as seconds before the attack. Really, opposing counsel indicates that the riot happened about a minute into this video. His still photograph is at second 49, I believe, of the video, approximately. There is no view of the barbershop door at all, even once, before that still photograph is taken. So Jackson could have come out and signaled that attack at any time before that. And even as you go back, and we would urge the court to go back and look at this video more slowly and pause it at certain points, and you will notice that of the relevant 2 minutes, about 20 seconds, there's only 9 seconds of video where you can even see the door. And for the first 51 seconds, there's no view of the barbershop door. And then there's 3 seconds where you can see the barbershop door. And then from second 55 to minute 119, the camera completely shifts angles. That group of inmates is still out in front of the barbershop door. The video shifts all the way to the other side of the corridor. And you have a 24 seconds where you can't see anything relevant. It comes back, and then again, there's another 6 seconds where you can see the barbershop door, and then it stops at a point where technically you don't see the barbershop door. You do see the area out in front of it a little bit. And I think that it's that ambiguity, and actually Justice Prosser brought up a good point. Jackson admits he left at some point, and that's not even shown. And it's that ambiguity that leads us to believe this is immaterial and not exculpatory. I think that's what led the circuit court to believe this is not exculpatory and not material, because it simply cannot contradict the evidence relied on. And so that being said, I think it should also be noted that even considering the video then, and if this court decides to consider it as part of its review and make the assumption that the committee reviewed it, there is still sufficient evidence to find the committee's decision reasonable. And I think it's important to keep in mind that if this court decides to consider the video as part of the evidence in this record, finds that it should have been properly part of the record in return, then you are making the assumption that the committee viewed that evidence, and then you necessarily have to give the committee the discretion it deserves to weigh the evidence. And this court can't go back and on certiorari review and reweigh evidence that the committee has already weighed. And if there are two opposing views of the evidence, you can't substitute your view for the agency's view. And granted, the committee doesn't discuss the video explicitly. I mean, it lists it on that list, but it doesn't discuss it specifically. But it does give its reasons for decision, so it is.
Let me stop you for just a moment. And I want to stop you on something you just said. Sufficient evidence to find the committee decision reasonable, whether if the video is there or not. Can you detail for us what you're talking about with sufficient evidence?
Would you like the standard or the evidence I think is sufficient?
Standard.
The standard.
And the evidence.
Okay. The standard is whether or not there is any reasonable view of the evidence could support the committee's decision, is basically what it comes down to. And under the substantial evidence test, this court is not given it does not have the authority to weigh the credibility of certain pieces of evidence or weigh the weight of it. You have to go back and look and see if there's any reasonable view of the evidence that supports the committee's decision. And I think this is a point that the circuit court's findings of immateriality support the committee's finding that the video does not contradict the other evidence. Now, as to the second part of your question, what evidence do I think makes it sufficient, there is case law that says that a conduct report alone is sufficient evidence. Here we have a conduct report. We have two confidential informant statements taken from inmates separately without their knowledge of each other that both implicate Mr. Jackson. We also, in the conduct report, have other inmates' testimony that they weren't, you know, they're not confidential informants, so we don't know if they were corroborated, but they also implicate Mr. Jackson. So there is, under the case law on sufficiency of the evidence, there is more than sufficient evidence without the video. With the video, it's our position the video has no effect on that. It simply the video does not show relevant content for any significant or sufficient amount of time in order to really contradict that evidence.
Could you comment on the word seconds?
Sure. What I think it means, or?
Yeah, anything.
I think in this context, when we're talking about really probably about a minute, a little over a minute of real relevant footage before the rioters actually kind of leave that area, I think any time within there could constitute seconds. And I think the use of the term seconds in the conduct report is noteworthy, possibly. I think it is much more persuasive to look at what the actual the confidential informant said themselves, because the conduct report is simply taking those confidential informant statements, summarizing them, and coming to a recommendation for the committee. So I think it's more secondhand to kind of weigh the language used in the conduct report. But that said, it's our position that the video doesn't even contradict the phrasing in the conduct report, because this all really happened seconds before the attack. And the fact is, when you go back and look at it and you kind of look at those times I mentioned on the video, you can't see the barbershop door seconds before the riot, so we don't know what's going on here. We know that from, and I think it was second, like 55 to 119, which is seconds before the riot, technically, the video shifts all the way to the other end of the corridor. So
where are the conspirators there on the tape? Where are they in that time?
At that section, that 55 to 119 section? Well, we don't see them either.
Don't see anybody.
We don't see anybody relevant. So that is why we continue to maintain that with even considering the video, we have sufficient evidence here. And so although we understand why the court is interested in the video, and we understand the court needed to post remand, needs to kind of see the video in order to determine whether the circuit court's findings are reasonable, we don't think it really has any effect on the actual, the sufficiency of the evidence analysis. Now, if you're going to a Brady analysis, which is a separate analysis, it's our position this really isn't, again, this really isn't a Brady violation claim because of the, all of the, on the record as it stands right now, none of the prerequisites for a Brady violation claim have been satisfied. So we just don't have a record on which to really even review a Brady violation claim. There was no request to see the video, so there was no opportunity for the Department of Corrections to say if it had a security concern with showing the video. And although this is not in the record, I imagine at the time, if he had requested it, they would have had security concerns. There had just been a riot, and this was the person who was instigating the riot in their mind, and this shows camera angles for their security cameras. So they very well might have denied the request based on security, and then at that point it becomes part of the certiorari review record, that denial, and that issue on whether or not it was properly denied or whether or not the video is material and or exculpatory becomes part of the certiorari review process. Here, the remand was done wholly outside of the scope of certiorari review because the video issue never came up in a way that the circuit court could do an in-camera review within the scope of certiorari review. So we see that as affecting the effect of the circuit court's findings. And at most, what the circuit court's findings do is moot Brady violation.
Let me ask you this. Let us assume that, according to the conduct report, the person who made that out viewed videos, right?
Correct.
Okay. The record shows that the disciplinary committee viewed the video. That's their own writing, okay? Whether it was viewed for one charge or the other, they saw it.
right?
Okay. Maybe. We don't know with regards to
Jackson. Well, that's what the written record shows.
That's what the evidence relied on list does say video. We can
see
that.
Twice. It says video. I mean, why should we say they didn't see it when they said they did? And it's not checking a box for video. Mm-hmm. Somebody hand wrote that, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, would you say that in light of those two matters, that we should assume there was a video and that it was seen? That's the most reasonable inference, right?
That wouldn't be our position. I mean, we would say we have to look at the record on return as it stood when it was sent up, and that's after the correction was made, and then we have more.
But when it was corrected, it must have been removed. Your position is it never was there, warden never saw it, mm-hmm. and that therefore you can just strike it out because it's mm-hmm. It's typographical error. That's your position?
Correct.
How does the warden know it wasn't seen?
We don't know, although I think contrary to opposing counsel's current argument on this, I think the record on return supports the warden's determination that it wasn't used by looking at the conduct report and the actual description
of
what
if the warden saw it. If not, he saw it and thought it was irrelevant. Well, he didn't see it, and he knew by some magic that no one ever saw this video. Therefore, it had to be removed, right? Either way.
Isn't it possible that it was just never there? It was never in the record that came to him, so he took it off the paper, which said it was there. So we don't even know what he got. We don't know if their video was ever there. Period.
I would agree with that. That's the way we read this record in return, and that's what we would submit to the court, is that from the way he describes it on his correction sheet, this was an error he found on the decision sheet. And it was not a decision he didn't view the video and make a substantive determination that this is immaterial. He said, no, there's a problem. And although none of this is in the record, practically speaking, he probably had seen the video or some of the video footage. He was a warden at an institution that had a serious riot on its hands where there were dozens of inmates who were going through this process. Mm-hmm. And so, practically speaking, he probably did know what the video showed. But there's no indication that he viewed it in conjunction with his correction. And there's
no indication. On his memory.
Possibly or not even that. Maybe he looked at the conduct report in this case and said, this is not the same as the rest of these cases. This is the instigator. This is not the participant.
That report refers to the video. This is on the basis of the video, too. Okay.
Okay. So we would, again,
suggest this is an ideal record made by the disciplinary committee, the Department of Corrections, or the warden.
It's far from ideal. I would like some different wording and more explanation, but we don't have that. I would maintain that it is sufficient to see that the video was, it is supported by the record that the video was not considered by the committee. It was not discussed at all in their description. Jackson, another reason why I would say it supports that it wasn't shown is that Jackson never, at any administrative level, requested to see it. It was never brought up. I would think it would at least come up at the hearing if it had been viewed at the hearing or around the time of the hearing. And there was no issue regarding the video until the correction was made.
But would they have viewed this before the hearing? Would they, because of the department has, I think if I remember correctly in the last one, counsel said this is a security problem to see these, inmates shouldn't know where the cameras are, what the angles are, what they do and what they don't do, that this is a security issue. So it's quite possible that they saw this before the hearing, if they saw it, right? Or
whether it's quite possible or just possible, I don't know. It's we don't know from the record. But again, there were a lot of cases surrounding this riot. So,
does the disciplinary committee have the full statements of the confidential informants, or just the summary from the investigation?
The full statements aren't in the record, as far as I know.
Are not.
They're not.
I know that, but
okay. I'm not sure. I mean, this is 2004.
Know.
I'm not sure what they had. We can, again, kind of only speculate on that. Generally speaking, they're kept somewhere. Very often, though, from my experience, they are very similar to the summaries in a lot of ways. So in this case, they could have been very similar to summaries. But
Counsel, I understand, I think, your position on Brady. But I just can't quite grasp why there is this resistance, given the fact that there are documents in the record that say the video was utilized in some way, why it is that the record should not have had that video, if it in fact was part of the record at some point. I'm just not getting it. What am I missing?
Well, I think it partly, again, relates back to this characterization of the video issue. I think we are so far removed now from when the return was compiled and sent to the circuit court that we have a lot of different bases on which to say that issue isn't really properly before the court. And, you know, it's been so many years and so many courts between the compilation of the record and now that makes it's a harder issue to address. But at the time, the issue was addressed at the circuit court. He made a motion to strike the return. And the circuit court affirmed the warden's decision saying no video was viewed. And that issue, that was probably, in my mind, the issue that should have been appealed, and it wasn't. It was turned into a Brady violation, which has other reasons for being denied, because he didn't ask for it, and he doesn't have a viable Brady violation claim. So I think we've gotten to where we are now because the issue was confused by probably Mr. Jackson and maybe the court and maybe counsel on both sides or one side at that point. So it's hard to say now why. I mean, now we have a lot of reasons why we're kind of defending the record on return. Part of that is procedural too, but at the time, I think it was looked at to a certain extent. He never made any. He had no indication that he wanted to see the video until the warden corrected the decision sheet. And at that time, the circuit court addressed it in response to Jackson's motion to strike the return and agreed with the warden on that issue. Whether or not that's proper, that's another issue. But I think at the time, it did not seem as mysterious an issue as it has become on appeal when it has become a Brady, it has Brady implications now and based on how it's been characterized. So. But that's the only mystique I can kind of identify for you. Well, I see my time is up, so unless there's any other questions, I'll just conclude by saying that post-remand, we really do feel that there is even more reason to disregard Jackson's Brady violation claim or the issue of the video generally, because whether or not it's characterized as a sufficiency of the evidence claim or a Brady rule violation, the circuit court should be given some amount of deference on this issue because there's a reason it was sent back. And the court determined that it was immaterial and not exculpatory, and that should moot any Brady claim as far as we're concerned because it precludes the necessary elements of a Brady claim. And as to the sufficiency of the record on return, I think it's a collateral, even though it's outside the scope of review from our position, it's a collateral kind of affirmance of the reasonableness of the warden's decision. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I guess I'll ask you one more question. You just don't think Brady applies at all in a discipline case. Is that right?
Not at this time.
Not at this time means because you don't have a case that says that it does apply? Well, we have lots of issues that come to the court, and we don't have an exact case that says, hey, it's constitutional or it's not constitutional, or do it or don't do it. What happens is counsel argues on the basis of the existing law that's not definitive. So what's the state's position?
The state's position is it does not apply right now.
Period.
Period. And if that, you know, if that's going to change, then there's, I would urge you to go back and kind of look at our briefs and oral argument on that issue more thoroughly again. But there are a lot of issues that need to be addressed in applying such a rule in this context that I think don't come into play in the Seventh Circuit's other case law because at least a lot of that case law comes out of Indiana, and there isn't a certiorari review process for inmate disciplinary decisions. So they're all starting at that federal district court level. And it's a different application here in Wisconsin. We have a unique system for that. We have a state certiorari process to address these things. And I think application in this context will be very different.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Potts.
Thank you.
Counsel?
The request of the state, frankly, is that this court abandon any meaningful certiorari review. It is not meaningful certiorari review to allow the agency to take evidence out of the record before it goes off for court review. It is not meaningful review of the substantial evidence to say that the fact finder can rely on confidential informant's testimony and that the meeting occurred seconds before, when that testimony is not only inconsistent with the other testimony, but that is inconsistent with that video. One can equivocate on whether or not 120 seconds is a meaningful use of the word seconds, but I don't think that that is a typical way one uses seconds, and indeed it's not the way that the state itself understood seconds until we received the video, because in the state's principal brief in this matter filed before the December argument, they said that the meeting occurred immediately before the riot occurred. The video is inconsistent with that. And not only is there not substantial evidence, but that would have implicated, had the video been shown, the fact that Mr. Jackson wanted to present the other witnesses who were said to have participated in this meeting. Why were they not cumulative? They were not cumulative because even if one accepts that maybe when the camera spins around, Mr. Jackson could have dashed out of the barbershop, spoke with those persons and dashed back in about the 2 seconds that the camera spins around, something I suggest is quite frankly impossible, and therefore there is no substantial evidence. But if that was possible, then that would have been a ground to allow those other witnesses. And given what is on that video, and given the state's knowledge of the video, Brady does apply. As a matter of due process, the state should have turned that video over, played it to Mr. Jackson, and this rule already applies to the state of Wisconsin. This court hasn't spoken to it, but the Seventh Circuit has. And the Seventh Circuit's interpretation of the law of the United States governs the state's activities in this state.
No, it doesn't. Our decisions govern the state's activities, and we are not bound by the Seventh Circuit, Counselor.
No. Your Honor, if I may clarify, the Seventh Circuit's decisions on United States law govern the state's conduct, its activities that occur in the geographic region that is known as the state of Wisconsin, as a matter of federal law. Because if someone takes a case to federal court, the Seventh Circuit's decisions bind the district courts in the court of Wisconsin. That's uncontestable.
But they don't bind this court, and you are now before this court. If you wanted this matter to be in the Seventh Circuit, then I agree with you. You would have a different analysis that might be applied.
I agree those decisions do not bind this court. But, Your Honor, the state can't say that its activities are not subject to the Seventh Circuit's interpretation of the law, which means that the state is already saddled, if they believe it's a big burden, with dealing with whatever requirements that interpretation of the law shows. And although they now, in retrospect, argue that, well, maybe, possibly, there were security concerns, no one addressed those concerns because no one's presented the tape, either the video, either to Mr. Jackson or even anyone, acting on his behalf. He did have the inmates person to assist him at the time. No video was shown. No video was suggested. So these are important issues about how, in the state of Wisconsin, certiorari review is going to meaningfully occur. And this court should address all of those issues, and it should reverse the conclusion of the disciplinary committee. And I thank you for your generous time and attention today.
Counsel, if we would reverse the disciplinary committee, wouldn't it just go back for another hearing?
I don't read the state as requesting another hearing, Your Honor, but yes, if the state was requesting, then a vacating of the disciplinary committee would leave the state free to, if it was inclined to do so, to attempt to reconvene a new disciplinary committee and, allowing all the evidence available, see if they could once again deprive Mr. Jackson of 6 months of his life based on that evidence.
Any other questions of Mr. Helfringer? There are no further questions. I will thank counsel for the long efforts done on behalf of the court appointing you, and I want to thank Ms. Potts for the efforts of the state in presenting all the evidence and in the numerous briefs and supplemental material that the state has given to the court. So with that, we terminate 06AP948, Darnell Jackson versus Daniel Buechler. And this ends our sitting in oral arguments for September. The students will remain if they can, and Justice Wilkinsack will be out and will discuss the procedures. We are adjourned from oral argument in September.